and sometimes she would proudly inform Zena that his chauffeur had driven her home, or at least as far as the tram stop. Zena had to work not only at translations, but also, as did all the other typists, at copying out the long applications presented at court. Frequently, she also had to take down in shorthand, in the presence of a client, the circumstances of his case, very often dealing with divorce. These cases were all fairly sordid, lumps of all sorts of muck and stupidity stuck together. A person from Cottbus, divorcing a wife who, according to him, was abnormal, accused her of consorting with a Great Dane. The chief witness was the janitress, who through the door had allegedly heard the wife talking to the hound and expressing delight concerning certain details of its organism. "To you it's only funny," said Zena crossly, "but honestly I can't go on, I can't, and I would abandon all this scum right away if I didn't know that another office would have the same scum, or worse. This worn-out feeling in the evening is something phenomenal. It baffles any description. What am I good for now? My spine aches so much from that typewriter that I feel like howling. And the main thing is that this will never end, because if it came to an end, there'd be nothing to eat. Mother can't do anything. She can't even work as a cook, because she'd only sob in her employer's kitchen and break the dishes. And her filthy husband only knows how to go bankrupt. In my opinion, he was already bankrupt when he was born. You've no idea how I hate him. He's a swine, a swine, a swine. One could make ham out of him," said Fyodor. "I also had a fairly hard day. I wanted to write a poem for you, but somehow it hasn't quite cleared up yet." "My darling, my joy," she exclaimed, "can all this be true? This fence and that blurry star? When I was little, I didn't like drawing anything that didn't finish, so I didn't draw fences because they don't finish on paper. You can't imagine a fence that finishes. But I always did something complete, a pyramid or a house on a hill. And I liked horizons most of all, and diminishing dashes beneath it to represent the wake of the sun setting beyond the sea. And the greatest childhood torment of all was an unsharpened or broken crayon pencil. But then the sharpened ones. Do you remember the white one? Always the longest? Not like the red and blue ones, because it didn't do much work, do you remember? But how much it wanted to please. The drama of the albino, l'inutile beauté. Anyhow, later I let it have its fill, precisely because it drew the invisible and one could imagine lots of things. In general, there await us unlimited possibilities. Only no angels. Or if there must be an angel, then with a huge chest cavity and wings like a hybrid between a bird of paradise and a condor, and talons to carry the young soul away. Not embraced, as Lermontov has it. Yes, I also think that we can't end here. I can't imagine that we could cease to exist. In any case, I wouldn't like to turn into anything. Into diffused light? What do you think of that? Not too good, I'd say. I'm convinced that extraordinary surprises await us. It's a pity one can't imagine what one can't compare to anything. Genius is an African who dreams up snow. Do you know what it was that most amazed the very first Russian pilgrims when they were crossing Europe? The music? No, the fountains in the cities, the wet statues. It sometimes annoys me that you have no feeling for music. My father had such an ear that sometimes he would lie on the sofa and hum a whole opera from beginning to end. Once he was lying like that, and someone came into the next room and began talking to Mother, and he said to me, "That voice belongs to so-and-so. I saw him 20 years ago in Carlsbad, and he promised to come and see me one day." That's what his ear was like.
"And I met Vishnevsky today, and he mentioned a friend of his who complained that Carlsbad was no longer what it used to be. Those were the days," he said. "You stand with your mug of water, and there next to you is King Edward, handsome, imposing man, suit of real English cloth. Now, why are you offended? What's the matter?"
"Never mind. There are some things you'll never understand."
"Don't say that. Why is your skin hot here and cold there? You're not cold. Better take a look at that moth by the lamp."
"I saw it long ago."
"Do you want me to tell you why moths fly toward the light?" "No one knows that."
"And you know?" It always seems to me that in a minute I'll guess, if I just think hard enough. My father used to say that it resembled most of all a loss of equilibrium, as when learning to ride a bike you're lured by a ditch. Light, in comparison with darkness, is a void. Look at it circling. But there's something deeper here. In a minute I'll get it. I'm sorry that you didn't write your book after all. Oh, I have 1,000 plans for you. I've such a clear feeling that one day you'll really lash out, write something huge to make everyone gasp.
All right, said Fyodor Konstantinovich jokingly, a biography of Chernyshevsky.
Anything you like, but it must be quite, quite genuine. I don't need to tell you how much I like your poems, but they're never quite up to your measure. All the words are one size smaller than your real words.
Or a novel. It's queer, I seem to remember my future works, although I don't even know what they will be about. I'll recall them completely and write them.
Tell me, by the way, how do you tend to see it? Are we going to meet all our lives like this, side by side, on a bench?
Oh, no, she replied in a musically dreamy voice. In the winter, we'll go to a dance. And this summer, when I have my holiday, I'll go to the sea for 2 weeks and send you a postcard of the breakers.
I'll also go to the sea for 2 weeks.
I don't think so.
And then, don't forget that we must meet sometime in the Tiergarten, in the Rosarium, where the statue of the princess is with the stone fan.
Pleasant prospects, said Fyodor.
But a few days later, he happened to come across that same copy of 8x8. He leafed through it, looking for unfinished bits, and when all the problems turned out to be solved, he ran his eyes over the two-column extract from Chernyshevsky's youthful diary. He glanced through it, smiled, and began to read it over with interest. The drolly circumstantial style, the meticulously inserted adverbs, the passion for semicolons, the bogging down of thought in mid-sentence and the clumsy attempts to extricate it, whereupon it got stuck at once elsewhere and the author had to start worrying it out all over again, the drubbing in, rubbing in tone of each word, the night moves of sense in the trivial commentary on his minutest actions, the viscid ineptitude of these actions, as if some workshop glue had got onto the man's hands and both were left, the seriousness, the limpness, the honesty, the poverty. All this pleased Fyodor so much. He was so amazed and tickled by the fact that an author with such a mental and verbal style was considered to have influenced the literary destiny of Russia, that on the very next morning he signed out the complete works of Chernyshevsky from the State Library. And as he read, his astonishment grew, and this feeling contained a peculiar kind of bliss. When a week later he accepted a telephone invitation from Alexandra Yakovlevna, "Why does one never see you? Tell me, are you free tonight?" He did not take 8x8 with him to show his friends. This little magazine now had a sentimental value for him, the memory of an encounter. Among the guests there, he found the engineer Cairn, and a capacious, very smooth-cheeked and taciturn gentleman with a fat, old-fashioned face by the name of Goryainov, who was well known for the fact that being able to imitate beautifully, by stretching his mouth wide, making moist ruminant sounds, and speaking in falsetto, a certain unfortunate cranky journalist with a poor reputation, he had grown so accustomed to this image, which thus had its revenge on him, that not only did he also pull down the corners of his mouth when imitating other of his acquaintances, but even began to look like it himself in normal conversation. Alexander Chernyshevsky, grown thinner and quieter after his illness, this being the price of redeeming his health for a while, seemed that evening quite lively again, and even his familiar tic had returned. But Yasha's ghost no longer sat in the corner, leaning on his elbow among disarrayed books. "Are you still pleased with your lodgings?" asked Alexandra Yakovlevna.
"Well, I'm very glad. You don't flirt with the daughter?"
"No? Apropos, I remembered the other day that at one time Mertz and I had some common acquaintances. He was a wonderful man, a gentleman in all senses of the word. But I don't think she cares very much to admit her origins."
"She does admit them?"
"Well, I don't know. I suppose you don't quite understand these matters." In any case, she's a girl with character, said the engineer Cairn. I once saw her at a meeting of the dance committee. She looked down her nose at everything.
And what's her nose like? Asked Alexandra Yakovlevna.
You know, to tell the truth, I didn't look at it very carefully. And in the final analysis, all girls aspire to be beauties. Let's not be catty.
Gurjainov, who sat with his hands clasped on his stomach, was silent, except that occasionally he lifted his fleshy chin with a bizarre jerk and shrilly cleared his throat, as if calling to someone.
Yeah, thank you, I would indeed, he said with a bow, whenever he was offered jam or a glass of tea. And if he wished to impart something to his neighbor, he did not turn toward him, but moved his head closer, still looking ahead, and, having imparted it or asked a question, slowly moved away again. In a conversation with him, there were strange gaps, because he did not back your speeches in any way and did not look at you, but would let the brown gaze of his small elephant eyes stray around the room and would convulsively clear his throat. When he spoke of himself, it was always in a gloomily humorous vein. His whole appearance evoked for some reason such obsolete associations as, for example, Department of the Interior, cold vegetable soup, glossy rubbers, stylized snow falling outside the window, stolidity, stolypin, statist.
Well, my friend, said Chernyshevsky vaguely, moving to a seat by Fyodor, what have you got to say for yourself? You don't look too well.
You remember, said Fyodor, once about 3 years ago you gave me the happy advice to describe the life of your renowned namesake?
Absolutely not, said Alexander Yakovlevich. A pity, because now I'm thinking of getting down to it.
Oh, really? Are you serious?
Quite serious, said Fyodor.
But how did such a wild thought get into your head? Chimed in Madame Chernyshevsky. Why, you ought to write, I don't know, say, the life of Batyushkov or Delvik, something in the orbit of Pushkin. But what's the point of Chernyshevsky?
Firing practice, said Fyodor.
An answer which is, to say the least, enigmatic, remarked the engineer Cairn, and the rimless glass of his pince-nez gleamed as he attempted to crack a nut with his palms. Dragging them by one leg, Gurjainov passed him the crackers.
Why not? Said Alexander Yakovlevich, coming out of a brief spell of musing. I begin to like the idea. In our terrible times, when individualism is trampled underfoot and thought is stifled, it must be a great joy for a writer to immerse himself in the bright era of the 60s. I welcome it.
Yes, but it's so distant from him, said Madame Chernyshevsky. There's no continuity, no tradition.
Frankly speaking, I myself wouldn't be very interested in resuscitating everything that I felt in this connection when I was a college student in Russia.
My uncle, said Cairn, cracking a nut, was thrown out of school for reading What to Do.
And what is your opinion? Said Alexandra Yakovlevna, addressing Gurjainov. Gurjainov spread his hands.
I don't have any particular one, he said in a thin voice, as if mimicking someone. I've never read Chernyshevsky. But when I come to think of it, a most boring, Lord forgive me, figure.
Alexander Yakovlevich leaned back slightly in his armchair, blinking, twitching, his face alternately lighting up in a smile and then fading again, and said,
Nevertheless, I welcome Fyodor Konstantinovich's idea. Of course, a lot strikes us today as both comic and boring, but in that era there is something sacred, something eternal. Now, utilitarianism, the negation of art, and so on, all this is merely an accidental wrapping, under which it is impossible not to distinguish its basic features, reverence for the whole human race, the cult of freedom, ideas of equality, equality of rights. It was an era of great emancipations. The peasants from the landowners, the citizen from the state, women from domestic bondage. And don't forget that not only were the best principles of the Russian liberation movement born then, a thirst for knowledge, steadfastness of spirit, heroic self-sacrifice, but also it was precisely in this era, fed by it in one way or another, that such giants as Turgenev, Nekrasov, Tolstoy, and Dostoevsky were developing. Moreover, it goes without saying that Nikolai Gavrilovich Chernyshevsky himself was a man with a vast, versatile mind, with enormous creative willpower. And the fact that he endured dreadful sufferings for the sake of his ideology, for the sake of humanity, for the sake of Russia, more than redeems a certain harshness and rigidity in his critical views. Moreover, I maintain that he was a superb critic, penetrating, honest, brave. No, it's wonderful. You must certainly write it. The engineer Cairn had already been on his feet for some time, walking about the room, shaking his head and bursting to say something. "What are we talking about?" he suddenly exclaimed, taking hold of the back of a chair. "Who cares what Chernyshevsky thought of Pushkin? Rousseau was a lousy botanist, and I wouldn't have been treated by Dr. Chekhov for anything in the world. Chernyshevsky was first of all a learned economist, and that's how he should be regarded. And with all my respect for Fyodor Konstantinovich's poetic talents, I'm somewhat doubtful that he's capable of appreciating the merits and demerits of his man's commentaries on John Stuart Mill." "Your comparison is absolutely wrong," said Alexandra Yakovlevna. "It's ridiculous. Chekhov didn't leave the slightest trace in medicine. Rousseau's musical compositions are mere curiosities. But in this case, no history of Russian literature can omit Chernyshevsky. But there's something else I don't understand," she continued swiftly. "What interest does Fyodor Konstantinovich have in writing about people and times to which his whole mentality is completely alien? Of course, I don't know what his approach will be, but if he, let's speak plainly, wants to show up the progressive critics, then it's not worth the effort. Voyinsky and Eichenwald did this long ago." "Oh, come, come," said Alexander Yakovlevich. "Das kommt nicht in Frage. A young writer has become interested in one of the most important epochs in Russian history and is about to write a literary biography of one of its major figures. I don't see anything strange in that. It's not very difficult to get to know the subject. You'll find more than enough books, and the rest all depends on talent. You say approach, approach, but granted a talented approach to a given subject, sarcasm is a priori excluded, is irrelevant. That's how it seems to me, at least." "Did you see how Koncheyev was attacked last week?" asked the engineer Cairn, and the conversation took another turn. Out on the street, when Fyodor was saying goodbye to Gurjainov, the latter retained his hand in his own large, soft hand, and said, puckering up his eyes, "Let me tell you, my lad, you're quite a joker. Recently there died the social democrat Bielinki, a kind of perpetual émigré, so to speak. He was exiled by both the Tsar and the proletariat, so that whenever he indulged in his reminiscences, he would begin, 'U nas v Genève, chez nous à Genève.' Perhaps you'll write about him as well?" "I don't understand," said Fyodor half-questioningly. "No, but on the other hand, I understood perfectly. You are as much preparing to write about Chernyshevsky as I am about Bielinki. But then you made a fool of your audience and stirred up an interesting argument. All the best. Good night." And he left with his slow, heavy gait, leaning on a cane and holding one shoulder slightly higher than the other. The way of life to which he had become addicted while studying his father's activities was now renewed for Fyodor. It was one of those repetitions, one of those thematic voices with which, according to all the rules of harmony, destiny enriches the life of observant men. But now, taught by experience, he did not allow himself his former slovenliness in the use of sources, and provided even the smallest note with an exact label of its origin. In front of the National Library, near a stone pool, pigeons strolled cooing among the daisies on the lawn. The books to be taken out arrived in a little wagon along sloping rails at the bottom of the apparently small premises, where they awaited distribution, and where there seemed to be only a few books lying around on the shelves, when in fact there was an accumulation of thousands. Fyodor would embrace his portion, struggling with its disintegrating weight, and walk to the bus stop. From the very beginning, the image of his planned book had appeared to him extraordinarily distinctly in tone and outline. He had the feeling that for every detail he ran to earth, there was already a place prepared, and that even the work of hunting up material was already bathed in the light of the forthcoming book, just as the sea throws a blue light on a fishing boat, and the boat itself, together with this light, is reflected in the water. "You see," he explained to Zena, "I want to keep everything, as it were, on the very brink of parody. You know those idiotic biographie romancée where Byron is coolly slipped a dream extracted from one of his own poems? And there must be, on the other hand, an abyss of seriousness. And I must make my way along this narrow ridge between my own truth and a caricature of it. And most essentially, there must be a single, uninterrupted progression of thought. I must peel my apple in a single strip, without removing the knife." As he studied his subject, he saw that in order to completely soak himself in it, he would have to extend his field of activity 2 decades in either direction. Thus, an amusing feature of the age was revealed to him, essentially trifling, but proving to be a valuable guideline. During 50 years of utilitarian criticism, from Bielinski to Mikhailovsky, there was not a single molder of opinion who did not take the opportunity to jeer at the poems of Fiet. And into what metaphysical monsters turned sometimes the most sober judgments of these materialists on this or that subject, as if the word, logos, were avenging itself on them for being slighted. Bielinski, that likable ignoramus, who loved lilies and oleanders, who decorated his window with cacti, as did Emma Bovary, who kept 5 kopecks, a cork and a button in the empty box discarded by Hegel, and who died of consumption with a speech to the Russian people on his blood-stained lips, startled Fyodor's imagination with such pearls of realistic thought as, for example, "In nature everything is beautiful, excepting only those ugly phenomena which nature herself has left unfinished and hidden in the darkness of the earth or water, mollusks, worms, infusoria, and so on." Similarly, in Mikhailovsky, it was easy to discover a metaphor floating belly upwards, as, for example, "Dostoevsky struggled like a fish against the ice, ending up at times in the most humiliating positions. This humiliated fish rewarded one for working through all the writings of the reporter on contemporary issues." From here, there was a direct transition to the fighting lexicon of the present day, to the style of Steklov, speaking of Chernyshevsky's times. The plebeian writer who nestled in the pores of Russian life branded routine opinions with the battering ram of his ideas. Or to the idiom of Lenin, who in his polemical heat attained the heights of absurdity. "Here there is no fig leaf, and the idealist stretches out his hand directly to the agnostic." Russian prose, what crimes are committed in thy name? A contemporary critic wrote about Gogol, "His people are deformed grotesques. His characters, Chinese lantern shadows. The events he depicts, impossible and ridiculous." And this fully corresponded to the opinions held by Skabichevsky and Mikhailovsky about Chekhov, opinions that, like a fuse lit at the time, have now blown these critics to bits. He read Pomyalovsky, Honesty in the Role of Tragic Passion, and found there this lexical fruit salad: little raspberry red lips like cherries. He read Nekrasov, and sensing a certain urban journalist defect in his frequently enchanting poetry, he found an apparent explanation for the vulgarisms in his pedestrian Russian Women. How jolly, furthermore, to share your every thought in common with someone you adore, in the discovery that, despite his walks in the country, he confused gadflies with bumblebees and wasps. Over the flock, a restless swarm of bumblebees, and 10 lines lower down, the horses under the smoke of a bonfire seek shelter from the wasps. He read Herzen, and was again better able to understand the flaw, a false glib glitter in his generalizations, when he noticed that this author, having a poor knowledge of English, witnessed by his surviving autobiographical reference, which begins with the amusing Gallicism, "I am born," had confused the sounds of two English words, beggar and bugger, and from this had made a brilliant deduction concerning the English respect for wealth. Such a method of evaluation taken to its extreme would be even sillier than approaching writers and critics as exponents of general ideas. What is the significance of Suhostchakov's Pushkin's not liking Baudelaire, and is it fair to condemn Lermontov's prose because he twice refers to some impossible crocodile, once in a serious and once in a joking comparison? Fyodor stopped in time, thus preventing the pleasant feeling that he had discovered an easily applicable criterion from being impaired by its abuse. He read a great deal, more than he'd ever read. Studying the short stories and novels of the men of the 60s, he was surprised by their insistence on the various ways their characters saluted one another. Meditating over the thraldom of Russian thought, that eternal tributary to this or that golden horde, he was carried away by weird comparisons. Thus, in paragraph 146 of the censorship code for 1826, in which authors were enjoined to uphold chaste morals and not to replace them solely by beauty of the imagination, one had only to replace chaste by civic, or some such word, in order to get the private censorship code of the radical critics. And similarly, when the reactionary Bulgarin informed the government in a confidential letter of his readiness to color the characters in the novel he was writing to suit the censor, one could not help thinking of the later fawning that even such authors as Turgenev indulged in before the court of progressive public opinion. And the radical Shchedrin using a cart shaft to fight with and ridiculing Dostoevsky's sickness, or Antonovich, who called that author a whipped and expiring animal, were little different from right-winger Burenin, who persecuted the unfortunate poet Nadson. In the writings of another radical critic, Zaitsev, it was comical to find 40 years before Freud the theory that all these aesthetic feelings and similar illusions elevating us are only modifications of the sexual instinct. This was the same Zaitsev who called Lermontov a disillusioned idiot, bred silkworms in leisured exile at Locarno, they never cocooned, and often crashed down the stairs from short-sightedness. Fyodor tried to sort out the mishmash of philosophical ideas of the time, and it seemed to him that in the very roll call of names in their burlesque consonants, there was manifested a kind of sin against thought, a mockery of it, a blemish of the age, when some extravagantly praised Kant, others Kant, K-O-N-T, Kant, C-O-M-T-E, others again Hegel or Schlegel. And on the other hand, he began to comprehend by degrees that such uncompromising radicals as Chernyshevsky, with all their ludicrous and ghastly blunders, were, no matter how you looked at it, real heroes in their struggle with the governmental order of things, which was even more noxious and more vulgar than was their own fatuity in the realm of literary criticism, and that other oppositionists, the liberals or the Slavophiles, who risked less, were by the same token worth less than these iron squabblers. He sincerely admired the way Chernyshevsky, an enemy of capital punishment, made deadly fun of the poet Zhukovsky's infamously benign and meanly sublime proposal to surround executions with a mystic secrecy, since in public, he said, the condemned man brazenly puts on a bold face, thus bringing the law into disrepute, so that those attending the hanging would not see, but would only hear solemn church hymns from behind a curtain, for an execution should be moving. And while reading this, Fyodor recalled his father saying that innate in every man is the feeling of something insuperably abnormal about the death penalty, something like the uncanny reversal of action in a looking-glass that makes everyone left-handed. Not for nothing is everything reversed for the executioner. The horse collar is put on upside down when the robber Razin is taken to the scaffold. Wine is poured for the headsman not with a natural turn of the wrist, but backhandedly. And if, according to the Swabian code, an insulted actor was permitted to seek satisfaction by striking the shadow of the offender, in China it was precisely an actor, a shadow, who fulfilled the duties of the executioner, all responsibility being, as it were, lifted from the world of men and transformed into the inside-out one of mirrors. He clearly sensed a deception on a governmental scale in the actions of the Tsar Liberator, who very soon got bored with all this business of granting freedoms. For it was the Tsar's boredom that gave the chief hue to reaction. After the manifesto, the police fired into the people at the station of Bezdna, and Fyodor's epigrammatic vein was tickled by the tasteless temptation to regard the further fate of Russia's rulers as the run between the stations Bezdna, bottomless, and Dno, bottom. Gradually, as a result of all these raids on the past of Russian thought, he developed a new yearning for Russia that was less physical than before, a dangerous desire, with which he successfully struggled, to confess something to her and to convince her of something. And while piling up knowledge, while extracting his finished creation out of this mountain, he remembered something else. A pile of stones on an Asian pass. Warriors going on a campaign each placed a stone there. On the way back, each took a stone from the pile. That which was left represented forever the number of those fallen in battle. Thus, in a pile of stones, Tamerlane foresaw a monument. By winter, he had already got into the writing of it, having passed imperceptibly from accumulation to creation. Winter, like most memorable winters, and like all winters introduced for the sake of a narrational phrase, turned out, they always turn out in such cases, to be cold. At his evening trysts with Zina, in an empty little cafe where the counter was painted an indigo color, and where dark blue gnome-like lamps, miserably posing as vessels of coziness, glowed on six or seven little tables, he read her what he had written during the day, and she listened, her painted lashes lowered, leaning on one elbow, playing with a glove or a cigarette case. Sometimes the proprietor's dog would come up, a fat mongrel bitch with low-hanging bubs, and would place its head on Zina's knee, and beneath the stroking and smiling hand that smoothed back the skin on its silky round forehead, the dog's eyes would take on a Chinese slant. And when she was given a lump of sugar, she would take it, waddle in a leisurely manner into a corner, roll up there, and very loudly start crunching. "Wonderful, but I'm not sure you can say it like that in Russian," said Zina sometimes. And after an argument, he would correct the expression she had questioned. Chernyshevsky, she called Chernish for short, and got so used to considering him as belonging to Fyodor and partly to her that his actual life in the past appeared to her as something of a plagiarism. Fyodor's idea of composing his biography in the shape of a ring closed with the clasp of an apocryphal sonnet, so that the result would be not the form of a book, which by its finiteness is opposed to the circular nature of everything in existence, but a continuously curving and thus infinite sentence, seemed at first to her to be incapable of embodiment on flat rectangular paper, and so much the more was she overjoyed when she noticed that nevertheless a circle was being formed. She was completely unconcerned whether or not the author clung assiduously to historical truth. She took that on trust. For if it were not thus, it would simply not have been worth writing the book. A deeper truth, on the other hand, for which he alone was responsible, and which he alone could find, was for her so important that the least clumsiness or fogginess in his words seemed to be the germ of a falsehood which had to be immediately exterminated. Gifted with a most flexible memory, which twined like ivy around what she perceived, Zina, by repeating such word combinations as she particularly liked, ennobled them with her own secret convolution. and whenever Fyodor for any reason changed a turn of phrase which she had remembered, the ruins of the portico stood for a long time on the golden horizon, reluctant to disappear. There was an extraordinary grace in her responsiveness, which imperceptibly served him as a regulator, if not as a guide. And sometimes, when at least three customers had gathered, an old lady pianist in pince-nez would sit at the upright piano in the corner and play Offenbach's Barcarolle as a march. He was already approaching the end of his work, the hero's birth, to be precise, when Zina said it would not hurt him to relax, and therefore on Saturday they would go together to a fancy dress ball at the house of an artist friend of hers. Fyodor was a bad dancer, could not stand German bohemians, and moreover refused point-blank to put fantasy in a uniform, which is what, in effect, masked balls do. They compromised on his wearing a half-mask and a dinner jacket that had been made about 4 years previously and not worn more than four times in the interim. "And I'll go as, she began dreamily, but cut herself short. "Only not as a boyar maiden and not as Columbine, I beg you," said Fyodor. "That would be just like me," said she scornfully. "Oh, I assure you, it'll be terribly gay," she added tenderly to dissipate his gloom. "Why, after all, we'll be all alone in the crowd. I so want to go. We'll be the whole night together, and no one will know who you are. And I've thought myself up a costume specially for you." He conscientiously imagined her with a naked, tender back and pale, bluish arms. But here, all kinds of excited, bestial faces slipped through illegally, the coarse trash of noisy German revels. Bad liquor inflamed his gullet. He belched from the chopped egg sandwiches. But he again concentrated his thoughts, revolving to the music, on Zina's transparent temple vein. "Of course it'll be gay. Of course we'll go," he said with conviction. It was decided that she should set off at 9, and he would follow an hour later. Cramped by the time limit, he did not sit down to work after supper, but fiddled around with a new émigré magazine, where Koncheyev was twice mentioned fleetingly, and these casual references, which implied the poet's general recognition, were more valuable than even the most favorable review. Only 6 months ago, this would have provoked in him what Pushkin's envious Salieri felt, but now he himself was amazed by his own indifference to another's fame. He looked at his watch and slowly began to change. He unearthed his drowsy-looking dinner jacket and lapsed into thought. Still meditating, he took out a starched shirt, put his evasive collar studs in, climbed into it, shivering from its rigid chill. Again was motionless for a moment, then automatically pulled on his black trousers with a stripe, and remembering that he had made up his mind only that morning to cross out the last of the sentences he had written the previous day, he bent over the already heavily corrected page. As he read the sentence over, he wondered, should he leave it intact after all? Made an insertion mark, wrote in an additional adjective, froze over it, and swiftly crossed out the whole sentence. But to leave the paragraph in that condition, that is, its construction hanging over a precipice with a boarded window and a crumbling porch, was a physical impossibility. He examined his notes for this part, and suddenly his pen stirred and started to fly. When he looked again at his watch, it was 3 in the morning. He had the chills, and everything in the room was dim from tobacco smoke. Simultaneously, he heard the click of the American lock. His door was ajar, and as she passed by it through the hall, Zina caught sight of him, pale, with mouth wide open, in an unbuttoned, starched shirt with suspenders trailing on the floor, pen in hand, and the half-mask on his desk showing black against the whiteness of paper. She locked herself in her room with a bang, and everything again grew quiet. "That's a fine mess," said Fyodor in a low voice. "What have I done?"
Thus, he never found out what dress Zena had gone in. But the book was finished. A month later, on a Monday, he took the fair copy to Vasilyev, who as early as last autumn, knowing of his investigations, had half offered to have the life of Chernyshevsky published by the house attached to the Gazeta. The following Wednesday, Fyodor was again there, chatting quietly with old Stupishin, who used to wear bedroom slippers at the office. Suddenly the study door opened and filled with the bulk of Vasilyev, who looked blackly at Fyodor for a moment and then said impassively, "Be so good as to come in," and moved to one side for him to slip through. "Well, have you read it?" asked Fyodor as he took a seat across the table. "I have," replied Vasilyev in a gloomy bass. "Personally," said Fyodor briskly, "I would like it to come out this spring." "Here's your manuscript," said Vasilyev suddenly, knitting his brows and handing him the folder. "Take it. There can be no question of my being party to its publication. I assumed that this was a serious work, and it turns out to be a reckless, antisocial, mischievous improvisation. I'm amazed at you."
"Well, that's nonsense, you know," said Fyodor.
"No, my dear sir, it's not nonsense," roared Vasilyev, irately fingering the objects on his desk, rolling a rubber stamp, changing the positions of meek books for review, conjoined accidentally, with no hopes for permanent happiness. "No, my dear sir. There are certain traditions of Russian public life which the honorable writer does not dare to subject to ridicule. I am absolutely indifferent to whether you have talent or not. I only know that to lampoon a man whose works and sufferings have given sustenance to millions of Russian intellectuals is unworthy of any talent. I know that you won't listen to me, but nevertheless..." And Vasilyev, grimacing with pain, clutched at his heart. "I beg you, as a friend, not to try to publish this thing. You will wreck your literary career. Mark my words. Everyone will turn away from you."
"I prefer the backs of their heads," said Fyodor. That night he was invited to the Chernyshevskys, but Alexandra Yakovlevna put him off at the last minute. Her husband was down with flu and ran a high temperature. Zina had gone to the cinema with someone, so that he only met her the next evening. "Kaput on the first try, as your stepfather would put it," he said in reply to her question about the manuscript, and, as they used to write in the old days, briefly recounted his conversation at the editorial office. Indignation, tenderness toward him, the urge to help him immediately, found expression with her in a burst of enterprising energy. "Oh, that's how it is," she exclaimed. "All right, I'll get the money for publication. That's what I'll do."
"For the baby a meal, for the father a coffin," he said, transposing the words in a line of Nekrasov's poem about the heroic wife who sells her body to get her husband his supper. And another time she would have taken offense at this bold joke. She borrowed somewhere 150 marks, and added 70 of her own, which she had put away for winter. But this sum was insufficient, and Fyodor decided to write to Uncle Olek in America, who regularly helped his mother, and who also used occasionally to send a few dollars to him. The composition of this letter was put off from day to day, however, just as he put off, in spite of Zina's exhortations, an attempt to get his book printed serially by an émigré literary magazine in Paris, or to interest the publishing house there, which had brought out Koncheyev's verses. In her free time, she undertook to type the manuscript in the office of a relation of hers, and from him she collected another 50 marks. She was angered by Fyodor's inertia, a consequence of his hatred for any practical affairs. He, in the meantime, occupied himself light-heartedly with composing chess problems, dreamily went about his lessons, and rang up Madame Chernyshevsky daily. Alexander Yakovlevich's flu had changed into an acute inflammation of the kidneys. One day in the Russian bookshop, he noticed a tall, portly gentleman with a large-featured face, wearing a black felt hat, a strand of chestnut hair falling from under it, who glanced at him affably and even with a kind of encouragement. "Where have I met him?" thought Fyodor quickly, trying not to look. The other approached and offered his hand, generously, naively, defenselessly spreading it wide,
spoke, and Fyodor remembered. It was Bush, who 2.5 years ago had read his play at that literary circle. Recently he had published it, and now, pushing Fyodor with his hip, nudging him with his elbow, an infantine smile trembling on his noble, always slightly sweaty face, he produced a wallet, from the wallet an envelope, and from the envelope a clipping, a pitiful little review which had appeared in the Regan Emigre newspaper. "Now," he said with awesome weightiness, "this thing is also coming out in German. Moreover, I am now working on a novel." Fyodor tried to get away from him, but the latter left the shop with him and suggested they should go together. And since Fyodor was on his way to a lesson, and thus was tied to a definite route, all he could do to try and save himself from Bush was to quicken his step. But this so speeded up his companion's speech that he slowed down again in horror. "My novel," said Bush, looking into the distance, and stretching aside his hand with a rattling cuff protruding from the sleeve of his black overcoat in order to stop Fyodor Konstantinovich. The overcoat, the black hat, and the strand of hair gave him the appearance of a hypnotist, a chess maestro, or a musician. "My novel is the tragedy of a philosopher who has discovered the absolute formula." He starts speaking, and speaks thus. Bush, like a conjurer, plucked a notebook out of the air and began to read on the move. "One has to be a complete ass not to deduct from the fact of the atom the fact that the universe itself is merely an atom, or it would be truer to say some kind of trillionth of an atom. This was realized with his intuition already by that genius Blaise Pascal. But let us proceed, Louisa." At the sound of this name, Fyodor started and clearly heard the sounds of the German grenadier march. "Farewell, Louisa, wipe your eyes and don't cry. Not every bullet kills a good guy." And this subsequently continued to sound as if passing under the window of Bush's subsequent words. "Exert, my dear, your attention. First, let me give a fanciful example. Let us assume that a certain physicist has managed to track down, out of the absolute unthinkable sum of atoms out of which the all is composited, that fatal atom with which our reasoning is concerned. We are supposing that he has brought his splitting down to the least essence of that very atom, at which moment the shadow of a hand, the physicist's hand, falls on our universe with catastrophic results, because the universe is but the final fraction of one, I think, central atom of those it consists of. It's not easy to understand, but if you understand this, you will understand everything. Out of the prison of mathematics, the whole is equal to the smallest part of the whole. The sum of the parts is equal to one part of the sum. This is the secret of the world, the formula of absolute infinity. But having made such a discovery, the human personality can no longer go on walking and talking. Shut your mouth, Louisa." "That's him talking to a cutie, his lady friend," added Bush, with good-natured indulgence, shrugging one mighty shoulder. "If you're interested, I can read it to you from the beginning sometime," he continued. "The theme is colossal, and you may I ask, what are you doing?" "I," said Fyodor with a slight smile, "I have also written a book about the critic Chernyshevsky, only I can't find a publisher for it." "Ah, the popularizator of German materialism, of Hegel's traducers, the Grobianistic philosophers. Very honorable. I am more and more convinced that my publisher will take your work with pleasure. He's a comic personality, and for him literature is a closed book. But I have the position of advisor to him, and he will hear me out. Give me your telephone number. I'll be seeing him tomorrow. And if he agrees in principle, then I'll skim through your manuscript, and I dare to hope that I'll recommend it in the most flattering manner." What rot, thought Fyodor, and therefore was extremely surprised when the next day the kind soul did, in fact, ring. The publisher turned out to be a plumpish man with a sad nose, reminding him somewhat of Alexander Yakovlevich, with the same red ears and a stipple of black hairs along each side of his polished bald pate. His list of published books was small, but remarkably eclectic. Translations of some German psychoanalytic novels done by an uncle of Bush's,
The Poisoner by Adelaida Svetozarov, a collection of funny stories, an anonymous poem entitled I. But among this trash there were two or three genuine books, such as, for example, the wonderful Stairway to the Clouds by Hermann Lander, and also his Metamorphoses of Thought. Bush reacted to the life of Chernyshevsky as to a good slap at Marxism, to the delivery of which Fyodor had not given the least thought when writing his work. And at the second meeting, the publisher, evidently the nicest of men, promised to publish the book by Easter, that is, in a month's time. He gave no advance and offered 5% on the first 1,000 copies. But, on the other hand, he raised the author's percentage to 30 on the second 1,000, which seemed to Fyodor both just and generous. However, he was completely indifferent to this side of the business, and to the fact that the sales of émigré writers seldom reached 500 copies. Other emotions overwhelmed him. Having shaken the moist hand of radiant Bush, he emerged onto the street like a ballerina flying out onto the fluorescent stage. The drizzle seemed a dazzling dew. Happiness stood in his throat. Rainbow nimbi trembled around the street lamps, and the book he had written talked to him at the top of its voice, accompanying him the whole time like a torrent on the other side of a wall. He headed for the office where Zena worked. Opposite that black building, with benevolent-looking windows inclined toward him, he found the pub where they were to meet. "Well, what news?" she asked, entering quickly. "No, he won't take it," said Fyodor, watching with delighted attention her face cloud as he toyed with his power over it and anticipated the exquisite light he was about to summon. Chapter 4. Alas, in vain historians pry and probe. The same wind blows, and in the same live robe truth bends her head to fingers curved cupwise, and with a woman's smile and a child's care examines something she is holding there, concealed by her own shoulder from our eyes. A sonnet, apparently barring the way, but perhaps on the contrary providing a secret link which would explain everything, if only man's mind could withstand that explanation. The soul sinks into a momentary dream, and now, with the peculiar theatrical vividness of those risen from the dead, they come out to meet us. Father Gavril, a long staff in his hand, wearing a silk garnet red chasuble, with an embroidered sash across his big stomach, and with him, already illuminated by the sun, an extremely attractive little boy, pink, awkward, delicate. They draw near. "Take off your hat, Nikolya." Hair with a russet glint, freckles on his little forehead, and in his eyes the angelic clarity characteristic of nearsighted children. Afterwards, in the quiet of their poor and distant parishes, priests with names derived from Cyprus, Paradise, and Golden Fleece recalled his bashful beauty with some surprise. The cherub, alas, proved to be pasted on tough gingerbread, which was too hard for many to bite into. Having greeted us, Nikolya again dons his hat, a gray downy top hat, and quietly withdraws, very sweet in his homemade little coat and nankeen breeches, while his father, a kindly cleric who dabbles in horticulture, entertains us with talk of Saratov cherries, plums, and pears. A whirl of torrid dust veils the picture. As is invariably noted at the beginning of positively all literary biographies, the little boy was a glutton for books. He excelled in his studies. For his first writing exercise, he painstakingly reproduced, "Obey your sovereign, honor him, and submit to his laws." And the compressed ball of his index finger thus remained ink-stained forever. Now the 30s are over, and the 40s have begun. At the age of 16, he had a sufficient grasp of languages to read Byron, Eugène Sue, and Goethe, being ashamed to the end of his days of his barbarous pronunciation, and already had a command of seminary Latin,
owing to his father's being an educated man. Besides this, he took Polish with a certain Sokolovsky, while a local orange merchant taught him Persian, and also tempted him with the use of tobacco. Upon entering the Saratov Seminary, he showed himself there to be a meek pupil and was never once flogged. He was nicknamed the Little Toff, although in fact he was not averse to general fun and games. In the summer he played dibs and took pleasure in bathing. Never did he learn to swim, however, nor to fashion sparrows out of clay, nor to make nets for catching tiddlers. The holes came out uneven, and the threads got tangled. Fish are harder to catch than human souls, but even the souls later escaped through the rents. In winter, in the snowy darkness, a rowdy gang used to tear downhill in a huge horse-drawn flat sled while roaring out dactylic hexameters. And the chief of police, in his nightcap, would pull aside his curtain and grin encouragingly, happy that the seminarist's frolics would frighten off any night burglars. He would have been a priest like his father, and would have reached very likely a high rank, but for the regrettable incident with Major Protopopov. This was a local landowner, a bon vivant, a wencher, a dog lover. It was his son that Father Gavril too hastily recorded in the parish register as illegitimate. Meanwhile, it transpired that the wedding had been celebrated, without fuss, true, but honorably, 40 days before the child's birth. Dismissed from his post as member of the consistory, Father Gavril fell into such a depression that his hair turned gray. "That's how they reward the labors of poor priests," repeated his wife wrathfully. And it was decided to give Nikolya a secular education. What later became of the young Protopopov? Did he find out one day that because of him was he seized with a sacred thrill? Or, tiring rapidly of the pleasures of ebullient youth, withdrawing? Incidentally, the landscape which not long before had with wondrous languor unfolded along the passage of the immortal Britschka, all that Russian viatic lore so untrammeled as to bring tears to the eyes, all the humbleness that gazes from the field, from a hillock, from between oblong clouds, that suppliant, expectant beauty which is ready to rush toward you at the slightest sigh and share your tears, in short, the landscape hymned by Gogol, passed unnoticed before the eyes of the 18-year-old Nikolai Gavrilovich, who with his mother was traveling in a carriage drawn by their own horses from Saratov to St. Petersburg. The whole way he kept reading a book. It goes without saying that he preferred his war of words to the corn ears bowing in the dust. Here the author remarked that in some of the lines he had already composed, there continued without his knowledge a fermentation, a growth, a swelling of the pea, or more precisely, at one or another point, the further development of a given theme became manifest. The theme of the writing exercises, for example. Already during his student days, Nikolai Gavrilovich was copying out for his own benefit Feuerbach's Man is What He Eats. It comes out smoother in German, and even better, with the help of the spelling now accepted, in Russian. Человек ест то, что ест. We remark also that the theme of nearsightedness develops too, beginning with the fact that as a child he knew only those faces which he kissed and could see only 4 out of the 7 stars of the Great Bear. His first copper spectacles donned at the age of 20. A teacher's silver spectacles bought for 6 rubles so as to distinguish his students in the cadet school. The gold spectacles of a moulder of public opinion put on in the days when the contemporary was penetrating to the most fabulous depths of the Russian countryside. Again, copper spectacles bought at a little trading post beyond Lake Baikal, where they also sold felt boots and vodka. The yearning for spectacles in a letter to his sons from Yakutsk territory, requesting lenses for such and such vision, with a line marking the distance at which he could make out writing. Here the theme of spectacles dims for a time.
Let us follow another theme, that of angelic clarity. This is how it developed subsequently. Christ died for mankind because he loved mankind, which I also love, for which I shall also die. Be a second Savior, his best friend advises him, and how he glows, oh timid, oh weak. An almost Gogolian exclamation mark appears fleetingly in his student diary. But the Holy Ghost must be replaced by common sense. Is not poverty the mother of vice? Christ should first have shod everybody and crowned them with flowers, and only then have preached morality. Christ the Second would begin by putting an end to material want, aided here by the machine which we have invented. And strange to say, but something came true. Yes, it was as if something came true. His biographers mark his thorny path with evangelical signposts. It is well known that the more leftist the Russian commentator, the greater is his weakness for expressions like the Golgotha of the revolution. Chernyshevsky's passions began when he reached Christ's age. Here, the role of Judas was filled by Vsyevolod Kostomarov, the role of Peter by the famous poet Nekrasov, who declined to visit the jailed man. Corpulent Herzen, ensconced in London, called Chernyshevsky's pillory column the companion piece of the cross. And in a famous Nekrasov iambic, there was more about the crucifixion, about the fact that Chernyshevsky had been sent to remind the earthly kings of Christ. Finally, when he was completely dead, and they were washing his body, that thinness, that steepness of the ribs, that dark pallor of the skin, and those long toes, vaguely reminded one of his intimates of the removal from the cross. By Rembrandt, is it? But even this isn't the end of the theme. There is still the posthumous outrage, without which no holy life is complete. Thus, the silver wreath with the inscription on its ribbon, to the Apostle of Truth, from the institutions of higher education of the city of Kharkov, was stolen 5 years later from the ironwork chapel. Moreover, the cheerful sacrilegious broke the dark red glass and scratched his name and the date on the frame with a splinter of it. And then a third theme is ready to unfold, and to unfold quite fantastically if we don't keep an eye on it. The theme of traveling, which can lead to God knows what, to a tarantass with a gendarme in azure uniform, and even more to a Yakutsk sled harnessed to half a dozen dogs. Goodness, that Vilyuysk captain of the police is also called Protopopov. But for the time being, all is very pacific. The comfortable traveling carriage rolls on. Nikolai's mother, Evgenia Yegorovna, dozes with a handkerchief spread over her face while her son reclines beside her reading a book, and a hole in the road loses its meaning of hole, becoming merely a typographical unevenness, a jump in the line. And now again the words pass evenly by. The trees pass by, and their shadow passes over the pages. And here at last is St. Petersburg. He liked the blueness and transparency of the Neva. What an abundance of water in the capital! How pure that water was! He quickly ruined his stomach on it. But he particularly liked the orderly distribution of the water, the sensible canals. How nice when you can join this with that and that with this, and derive the idea of good from that of conjunction. In the mornings he would open his window, and with a reverence still heightened by the general cultural side of the spectacle, would cross himself facing the shimmering glitter of the cupolas. St. Isaac's, in the process of construction, was all in scaffolding. We'll write a letter to Father about the fired gold leaf of the domes, and one to Grandmother about the locomotive. Yes, he had actually seen a train, to which poor Bielinski, our hero's predecessor, had so recently looked forward when, with wasted lungs, ghastly, shivering, he had been wont to contemplate for hours through tears of civic joy the construction of the first railway station.
that same station again, on whose platform a few years later the half-demented Pisaryev, our hero's successor, wearing a black mask and green gloves, was to slash a handsome rival over the face with a riding crop. In my work, said the author, ideas and themes continue to grow without my knowledge or consent, some of them fairly crookedly, and I know what is wrong. The machine is getting in the way. I must fish this awkward spillikin out of an already composed sentence. A great relief. The subject is perpetual motion. The pottering with perpetual motion lasted about 5 years, until 1853, when, already a schoolteacher and a betrothed man, he burned the letter with diagrams that he had once prepared when he feared he would die, from that fashionable disease, aneurysm, before endowing the world with the blessing of eternal and extremely cheap motion. In the descriptions of his absurd experiments, and in his commentaries on them, in this mixture of ignorance and ratiocination, one can already detect that barely perceptible but fatal flaw which gave his later utterances something like a hint of quackery. An imaginary hint, for we must keep in mind that the man was as straight and firm as the trunk of an oak, the most honest of the honest, his wife's expression. But such was the fate of Chernyshevsky that everything turned against him. No matter what subject he touched, there would come to light, insidiously and with the most taunting inevitability, something that was completely opposed to his conception of it. He, for instance, was for synthesis, for the force of attraction, for the living link. Reading a novel, he would kiss the page where the author appealed to the reader. And what was the answer he got? Disintegration, solitude, estrangement. He preached soundness and common sense in everything, and as if in response to someone's mocking summons, his destiny was cluttered with blockheads, crack brains, and madmen. For everything, he was returned a negative hundredfold, in Stranolyubsky's happy phrase. For everything, he was back-kicked by his own dialectic. For everything, the gods had their revenge on him. For his sober views on the unreal roses of poets, for doing good by means of novel writing, for his belief in knowledge. And what unexpected, what cunning forms this revenge assumed. What if, he muses in 1848, one attached a pencil to a mercury thermometer, so that it moved according to the changes in temperature? Starting with the premise that temperature is something eternal, but, excuse me, who is this? Who is this making laborious notes in cipher of his laborious speculations? A young inventor, no doubt, with an infallible eye, with an innate ability to fasten, to attach, to solder inert parts together, having them give birth in result to the miracle of movement. And lo, a loom is already humming. Or an engine with a tall smokestack and a top-hatted driver is overtaking a thoroughbred trotter. Right here is the chink with the nidus of revenge, since this sensible young man, who, let us not forget, is only concerned with the good of all mankind, has eyes like a mole, while his blind white hands move on a different plane from his faulty but obstinate and muscular mind. Everything that he touches falls to pieces. It is sad to read in his diary about the appliances of which he tries to make use. Scale arms, bobs, corks, basins, and nothing revolves. Or if it does, then according to unwelcome laws, in the reverse direction to what he wants. An eternal motor going in reverse. Why, this is an absolute nightmare. The abstraction to end all abstractions. Infinity with a minus sign. Plus a broken jug into the bargain. We consciously have flown ahead. Let us return to that jog-trot, to that rhythm of Nikolai's life to which our ear had already become attuned. He chose the philological faculty. His mother went to pay her respects to the professors in order to cajole them. Her voice would acquire flattering overtones, and gradually she would begin to wax tearful and blow her nose. Out of all the St. Petersburg products, she was most struck by articles made of crystal. Finally, they, the respectful pronoun he used in speaking of his mother, that wonderful Russian plural, which, as later his own aesthetics, attempts to express quality by quantity, returned to Saratov. For the road, she bought herself an enormous turnip. At first, Nikolai Gavrilovich went to live with a friend, but subsequently he shared an apartment with a cousin and her husband. The plans of these apartments, as of all his other abodes, were drawn by him in his letters. The exact definition of the relations between objects always fascinated him, and therefore he loved plans, columns of figures, and visual representations of things, the more so since his agonizingly circumstantial style could in no way compensate for the art of literary portrayal, which for him was unattainable. His letters to his relatives are the letters of a model youth. Instead of imagination, he was prompted by his obliging good nature as to what another would relish. The Reverend liked all sorts of events, humorous or horrible incidents, and his son carefully fed him with them over a period of several years. We find mentioned therein Easler's entertainments, his replicas of Carlsbad, Minerashki, miniature spas, at which venturesome St. Petersburg ladies used to ascend in captive balloons. The tragic case of the rowboat overturned by a steamer on the Neva, one of the victims being a colonel with a large family. The arsenic intended for mice, which got into some flour and poisoned over 100 people. And, of course, the new fad, table-turning. All gullibility and fraud, in the opinion of both correspondents. Just as in the somber Siberian years, one of his principal epistolary chords was the assurance addressed to his wife and children, always on the same high but not quite correct note, that he had plenty of money, please don't send money, so in his youth he begs his parents not to worry about him and contrives to live on 20 rubles a month.